Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm not a betting guy, but for those that are, there's betonline.ag. Football might be over, but NBA, college basketball, and the NHL are in full swing. And the only place you should be betting on these sports is at betonline.ag. BetOnline even covers awards, TV shows, and reality TV. BetOnline has hundreds of props with real-time odds on almost anything you can imagine. And of course, the 24-hour online casino. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. That's betonline.ag. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. What's up, y'all? It's time for another episode of Believe in Kentucky. BBN, we are here. I got double zero, the 96 champ, the NBA vet, Tony Delk. My name is Vinny Hardy. What's the good with you tonight, TD?
Brother, man, another night, man. Without snow here in Atlanta, not to say that it's going to come. We don't have snow. I think there's snow in every part of the country except in hot Atlanta. And it's not really hot here, but it's really cold Atlanta. So, man, just enjoying this cold weather.
Yeah, and got a special guest that you know very, very well in here. I think you might have froze up, but he's back with us now. So I gotta let you bring him in, man.
Oh yeah, man. Hey, this dude and I, we've been friends since 1992, Kentucky McDonald's Derby Festival, which I didn't want to go to. My mom forced me to go there, but you know, if I hadn't gone, this guy and I wouldn't have been roommates, you know, for 4 years in college. You know, unbelievable guy, great coach, won a championship together. We went through a lot of trials and tribulation, actually played in the league together on the same team with Boston Celtics. Tenure vet, has coached on all three levels. Well, two levels, I would say college and NBA. But just a remarkable dude, just what he's done for the game and how he's helped so many people out. One of my good friends, one of my best friends, Slim Walter McCarty.
What's happening, guys? Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Appreciate you being here, man. Good to meet you. Watched your career like I did Tony's, and cool to be sitting here talking with you, man. It really is.
Yeah, we got a lot of stories.
It, man. Thanks for having me on, man.
We can't tell them all on the podcast. You know, we're going to keep this.
We can't tell all of them.
PG, you know what I'm saying? PG, G and PG. That's how we do it. But, you know, just having Walter as a roommate, man, you know, and Walter first year, he was setting out, and it was a year where I didn't play a lot either. So really just get a chance, man, to grow as young men. I mean, that's what we had the opportunity to do and come in and play for one of the, you know, Hall of Fame coach and Coach Pitino. Walter was, you know, a player that came in and, you know, like I said, we both had to get acclimated to the collegiate game. And Walter can speak, you know, on himself just how his first year was. You know, everybody see us winning that championship in 96, but can you explain to our listeners, you know, tell them about that first year in 1992, how it went, how it started, how it ended, and everything that happened in between.
Yeah, it was tough. So the first year coming in, you know, I weighed 190 pounds because I was a prop practice with the team at all. So that was tough in itself, not being able to practice with the team and having to find ways to stay in shape, scouts in and stuff like that. Because nowadays you can actually practice with your team if you have to sit out a year and do all that stuff. And but the only thing I could do was work out with my strength coach. So that was really tough. So I didn't go, you know, for me to not miss it as much games, you know, I stayed on campus or watched on TV or whatever, but because it was tough setting up that first year. And, you know, we were the number one recruiting class coming in, and not to be able to play that first year was tough. But what it did allow me to do was allow me to put on some weight and get stronger. So I took full advantage of being in the weight room, but it was tough. So, you know, I got to hear a lot of the stories and the struggles from Delk, you know, coming home from practice or coming home after a game and not being able to play a lot of minutes and see those frustrations. So that really helped me a lot going into our sophomore season, really being prepared to have to grind it out, whatever minutes that I was going to get. And I remember that season starting off my sophomore year. You know, I was probably 206, 208, and I was playing the center. You know, I think his name was George Claxton or something like that. George Claxton was 300 pounds.
Big Charles Claxton.
Yeah, Charles Claxton. So I was guarding, having to come in and guard all these center stuff. I thought I was a small forward. Coming in, man, I think it really helped me a lot with my footwork, learning how to use my body, and just all those things really, really prepped us as far as just being able to do a lot of different things on the court and for that team, being able to get put in any situation and succeed in it. But it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of hard work. Fortunately for us, we had a lot of guys that were really talented and could really play. So we were challenged every day. Whether you was in the weight room, out in the track, or on the court. So it was a blessing for all those challenges every day and to be able to put it all together.
Yeah. So y'all was roommates the entire time, right?
Entire time, yeah. We got on each other's nerves.
it was some odd couple stuff, right? What did odd couple
We got on each other.
When y'all like the odd couple, one neat, one messy, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And you know who the messy one was. You know, hey, I had to counsel at the company. Oh, man. You know what? It is crazy too, because you know you have to. The room is divided, and I'm just like, dude, you got to keep your side of the room clean, man. You know, I was so organized, and I'm still like that to this day, man. I'm even more organized, but the funniest thing about, you know, us being together was I never forget when we went to, we had summer school together. So I happened to get there before Walter did. So they had bunk beds. So the first person there, you know, I wasn't going to take the top. I should have taken the top bunk. You take, you know, Walter 6'10". And I was like, man, you know what? I'm already here. How I look climbing up there and I'm here before him. So I took the bottom bunk. So pretty much every night, you know, getting ready for bed, man, if he didn't hit his head or like, you know, he was having problems, yeah, climbing up that little ladder, man, to get in that bed, I was like, man, I felt bad for my dude though, but you know, just how good of friends we were, man, you know, and just even to this day, you know, us talking, you know, more than periodically, you know, we always checking on each other, making sure everything is cool with the family, the kids. And it's so funny when you are roommates and you're 18 years old, and as we've, you know, gotten into turning 47, you know, he celebrated his birthday in February, and mine's in January, was that, you know, we had a lot in common. And that's when you can be with someone and, you know, although we're from different states and we grew up differently, you know, we always had basketball in common. Like, that was always our common denominator. And when you can have that personal, not really struggle, because I mean, we had our struggles, but it's really just defining who we were, you know, what we did in order to get a scholarship to make it to Kentucky. I think so many times, you know, kids don't understand how much work that goes into it. You know, Walter can, you know, he can contest to, you know, starting out as a freshman in high school, but it goes all the way back really to elementary and middle school, man, just the focus and, you know, for us, paying attention to details. And I think that's what made Walter, as I look back and I had a chance to sit in on a couple of his practices, I was like, man, this dude know this game from not only a player perspective, but he knows it from a coaching perspective. But there's two different kind of languages that people don't know.
Yeah, and I'm going to fast forward up to the present. And look, I got a ton of questions for Walter, too. November 2019, you come in with your hometown, Evansville University. You come in the Rupp Arena. You beat the Cats. TDU and I have talked about it on previous podcasts. You talked about how y'all were there. Y'all were there cheering for Walt. You made Big Blue Nation feel some type of way because we were a little bit happy for you, but we was like, man, you just come in and beat the Cats, so we couldn't. It was just a real conflicted kind of feeling.
Bittersweet, man. Just going to say it. Bittersweet. It was bittersweet.
It was all kind of weird. I turned on Freddie Coleman on ESPN Radio because we had him on my other podcast that y'all mentioned. I turned on Freddie Coleman that night, and there Walter is interviewing with Freddie, talking about beating the Cats in Rupp. So but since everything has transpired since then, how you been these past 15 months? How's everything with you, man? How you been? Oh, he's muted. Got you muted.
Sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Man, I'm great. I'm blessed. Everybody's healthy. You know, we're in a different time right now. That's, I think everybody's thrown out the loop a little bit, but I'm healthy. I'm blessed. I'm in the gym teaching and getting kids right, but I have no complaints. All is well, man, and just looking forward to the future, man. I really feel that God's got me in a place. He's got something special for me, and I can't wait. So I'm just sitting back, waiting, being patient for my time to come, and looking forward to it. But all is well, man. I can't complain. That game was great for our young people, for our guys. And as far as really bending yourselves and come together as one and really believe that you can do anything no matter what the odds are. And came together and played hard for me. But the most important thing, as Tony talked about, one thing about our Kentucky team, very talented. We were athletes, but we paid attention to details. Like, we all had really good IQs and we understood the game. And which is really important in basketball. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of kids overlook when they're thinking about trying to get to the NBA, to the next level. That, yeah, you may be talented or whatever, but if you can't pay attention to the details and game plans and all that stuff, you're not going to make it. And that team was the team that really played attention to details because we were not the most talented team.
I got to ask you the same question I asked Tony this several episodes back. Being that y'all have done so much in the game and worn so many different hats, how do you watch the game now? Do you watch it as a former player? You watch it as a coach? You put your analyst hat on? Do you watch as a fan? What hat are you wearing when you're just sitting watching the game?
It just depends. Like, you know, like sometimes I may watch a certain team because I want to see what type of actions they're running. So things that I'm interested in teaching the team are for something that I like for offensive part, and that's the coach in me. There's not a lot of guys like that. There's few in the league. So I'm watching the actions. But sometimes, man, I just sit back and just, you know, you're just a fan and you just, you know, you own and on. But I think for us, because we've been around the game so long, it's just like the Matrix. You know, when Neo found out he was the one, he read easily. Players like done it so much to understand why they did this, or why they did this, or why they did do this, or why he's in the game. So, I think you playing all those hats all at the same time. You take from it what you want, but a lot of times we're watching the game. We know what's going to happen because we know what plays are running, things that we've seen before. So, we kind of know what's happening. So for us, I just think it's just it's a little bit of all that. You're a fan, you're a coach, but you also can put yourself in that moment when guys hit big shots or when guys are feeling pressured or whatever. So you understand what they're going through. So I think it's all this.
Was there any when you look at the state of the game right now and you see how it's gone from you being a stretch four that when we go back 20 some years ago, it was uncommon to have a 4'5", 6'10" guy pick and pop, you know, be that stretch four. So as you've seen this game, how it has advanced, you know, was there anything differently you would have done as a player being in the position you win coming out of high school?
I think for me, this would have been the perfect league for me.
It's lagging a little bit.
Can you guys hear me?
There you go.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, gotcha.
All right. I'm trying to move around my house. Oh, can you hear me? All right.
Yeah.
So for me, to be honest, like today would have been a perfect time for me to play because this is how I play. Being able to run, being able to, you know, dribble, pass, shoot, and all that stuff, play different positions. But I think it helped me from playing my idea because it gave me to being at Kentucky 6'10". So it's not as it is. It's a totally different much of an impact as I did with those because, you know, I was
trying to get that audio corrected. I know he's
trying
to give us the best input and trying to find.
Yeah. We'll get him back. He's moving, he's relocating, and he's muted.
Yeah.
There you
go. Back to my original spot.
Yeah, hey, man. sound like you in a cave, man. Like we called you. You in the mountains in Massachusetts right now. So
man, we got so much snow here. But what I was saying, like for me, it was an advantage for me back when we played because, you know, I was playing against slower guys. I was able to get my shot off. I was able to be a threat in the corner. So as much as I fit in today's game, I think everybody's doing it, and it's not special anymore. You know, everybody's shooting threes now. So when you draw stuff up, it's a little different. So for me, I enjoyed being able to do what I did because I brought something extra to the table that a lot of teams didn't have. You know, everybody's a Robert Horry now. Guys who, you know, who made this position famous, you know, there's, I mean, I'm not saying they're as good as him or successful as him, but everybody's doing that now. But back then, it was a little different. If you had a guy like that, you could run a lot of different schemes and really, really throw teams off. So
makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. Real quick, when you look at these cats, what are your thoughts? Tony and I talked about it a lot. Talked about it a lot of different ways. a year like we haven't seen before, as far as UK is concerned. When you look at this team, the way it's put together, the way this season's played out, what have been your observations?
Well, I just hope these guys stay positive and they stay together. Everybody's had a tough year. Everybody's had a tough year from a basketball standpoint. And I thought, like, years like this, the teams are going to have the most success are teams who have older players who've been around, older guys who understand what it is their coach wants and how to execute what their coach wants. It's tough because Coach Cal has a lot of young players who hadn't spent a lot of time together. But then you, on top of COVID, hadn't spent a lot of practice time together, and they just haven't been able to mesh like his teams do. A lot of his young teams struggle early on. They don't lose this many games, but they struggle, but they get it together. And I think with COVID, it's just been unfortunate for them to try to overcome all the hurdles and the challenges that they have. They're very talented. And I just don't think they've had enough time to mesh and be the team he needs them to be. And, you know, this is nothing against other coaches. He has fine coaches, but I also think that, you know, KP was able to really put a step on kid as far as this is what we need from you. This is your role. You trying to make it, trust us. And we're going to get you to the next level. You know, trust Kyle, trust what he's doing. You know, he was that voice that was able to push his kids along to help Kyle out. And he didn't have that anymore from KP. So I think it's tougher to get what he's trying to get through to them. They probably understand it, but not as quick, you know? So I just hope they stay positive and, you know, hopefully, you know, they stick around a little bit and, learn this game and get better before they head off to the next level.
Have you guys, when you watch them, you talked about the struggles and they've lost more than they usually have, you know, with all the circumstances. Are you still seeing that effort and that fight? I mean, a team this young could easily have gotten beat down and maybe checked out. Have you still seeing them engaged and still bringing the fight every game?
Yeah, they're still engaged. They're still fighting. They're trying to win games. When you watch them, you can tell that they've learned. They're trying. They're trying. They're executing better. And they're doing a lot of things. They're just so young. They're so young and still so new. And again, how much are they really allowed to practice for with COVID and really, you know, get what they need to get out of practice and to have that confidence going in games? But it's tough because here's one thing. So when you're playing at University of Kentucky and you're struggling a little bit, guess what? These other schools, we've been beating up on schools so much. they understand. I was like, man, we got a wounded dog here. We got to jump. We always got everybody's best effort. So they're getting everybody's best effort, and they don't really have a chip on their shoulder. Like, we had a chip on our shoulder. We were really good. We were number one. We knew we was going to get everybody's best shot. But, you know, we were older. It's a little different. These guys are so young. They don't understand it yet. They haven't been through those wars, those challenges to understand that they're getting everybody's best game because they are Kentucky.
Speaking of getting everybody's best game, yesterday was the 27th anniversary of the Mardi Gras Miracle. Y'all got LSU's best shot in 1994. You talk about weathering a storm. How did y'all, the storm lasted the whole first half and part of the second half. How did y'all just hang in there to weather that monsoon? You got Henderson hitting threes, Caesar hitting threes, just going crazy. How did y'all weather that storm that night in Baton Rouge?
I'm gonna let Walter tell you his story, and I'm gonna tell you mine.
Yep, man, that was a crazy night. Man, to be like, so we looked back, we weren't playing well. We were getting smashed. We weren't playing well. We were playing good defense. Man, they just caught one. Man, they were shooting. Everything they threw up was going in. And, you know, I just remember at some point, you know, Coach P pulling us to the side. You know, we got a timeout. I think there was only like four or five of us walking over to the huddle. The guys are in the game, and he whispered, he said some words to us that kind of lit a fire, and the rest was out of fear. I'm not going to say what he whispered, but the rest was out of fear.
I'm not going to use the exact words. He was like, you MFs are going to pay tomorrow.
You motherfuckers are going to pay for this.
He told me, you better transfer back to Memphis, Walter, Indiana, Jerry Prickett, West Virginia. Hey, Broderick Rose was Seton Hall. So he had all the schools that were recruiting us. Say, tomorrow will be the worst day that you ever been as a Kentucky Wildcat. You know, we were just saying, hey, let's get it respectable and get it down to at least 15 points. And what Walter was even stating was that this team was, I've never seen a team this hot. Like, we were playing really good defense. I mean, you're talking about two guys that had unbelievable first half, and they were on fire. And there was really nothing we could do, you know, and that would have been our third loss in a row because we just lost to Arkansas on the road. We lost to Syracuse. And this would have been three losses, and we had never lost three games in a row. So that was another reason why coach was like, you know, tomorrow will be the worst day of your life. And as Walter stated earlier, like every time we played, you know, by the time we became a, you know, sophomore, junior, and especially when we became a senior, like we were every team's Super Bowl. So what these young players are experiencing right now, and they don't understand the history, tradition, all that stuff in Kentucky. And, you know, we started, you know, we helped build some, you know, some added tradition to what was already in existence. But we knew every night we came out, man, when you got that number one, number two, top five, teams are coming at you. And
coming for you.
We had to come and play our best game that we possibly played. And that was night in, every night, you know, every time we played someone, they were trying, they was giving us, you know, that best game. And I think as we got older, you know, we started understanding a little bit more how important it was for us to get off to a good start, but to stay focused. You know, Coach P, you know, we'll get into how great a coach he was, but just how detailed he was, the game plan, having great assistant coaches, you know, guys that were just as locked in as players. And that's something that, you know, as Walter was talking about, just the importance of having a KP. There's nothing against Bruiser, nothing against Tony Barbie, but KP was a different kind of motivator. You know, when you take guys who've been head coaches, it's a little bit different when you've been assistant coach. And now we've seen, you know, KP, what he's doing up in New York, you know, just got those guys playing at an unbelievable level. But it's a respect, but also it's how you address young men to get them motivated. And everybody doesn't have that motivation factor or how to motivate people. You know what I'm saying? It's one thing to talk to them, but how do you get an 18, 19-year-old kid who think he's playing as hard as he possibly can play? Like, we thought we played hard until we got to Kentucky. Like, I really thought I played hard until that very first individual struck me. About 20 minutes in, I needed an inhaler. It was like, I needed a defibrillator. It was like that exhausting. And I was thinking to myself, like, this was only 45 minutes. We gonna have a 3-hour practice at this level. But what he did was he gave us that level of intensity that we didn't have, that every kid needs at some point in time. And it comes from someone that goes on the inside of your body, man. Almost like they go in and take your soul out and was like, listen, you can give us more. You just gotta dig deeper. So he taught us, that is Coach Pitino, he taught us how to dig deeper, you know, and that's something that, you know, when I look back and I played for a lot of coaches, Walt played for a lot of coaches, but just how he got us to get to that level every day, practice, every day. There was not a day that Walter would tell you, he walked in, I walked in. Every day was intense from start to finish.
Yeah, and adding on to that, we can really say that we have never cheated a practice or individual instruction. We have never cheated one day as far as giving it 100%. It's just we never did that. And that's for a coach to be able to get that out of all his players, that's saying something.
You know what? I never even thought about that.
Yeah.
You know, as I have my youth program right here, and you know, and I try to tell these guys, you know, what they need to do. And, you know, I'm definitely going to share that with them tomorrow, you know, with how they come in and cheat us every day. I say, the one thing you're doing, you're cheating yourself. You know, yes, you're cheating your coach, you're cheating your teammates. But, you know, it's funny that Walter said that because I never thought, man, I never cheated that dude in practice. I never cheated. Never. But from that day on, I never cheated practice. You know what I'm saying? So I knew how to be loyal to practices, but I had to be taught that because I wasn't always taught that. When you're in high school, you are the most talented player. You know, Walter was the most talented player coming out of Evansville. I was the most talented player coming out of Brownsville. So, yeah, you know, we could take time off, possessions off. You know, we could take practice off. You know, we had the leeway. We had the green light. But that dude right there, it didn't matter who you were.
It didn't matter.
And I can tell you the story, like, with Walter and I being seniors, man, and I had started probably about 80 some games in a row. So he was talking about not starting me, taking both of us out of the starting lineup because he felt like we wasn't playing hard. And to me, that was the one time I was upset with Coach because I was like, Coach, you know, that's not true. You know what I'm saying? Like, if that's your motivation strategy that you're trying to use to maybe get the younger players to buy in, to play. I'm like, no, dude. And what Walter's saying is, we didn't cheat. So I know I haven't cheated you in practice. So for you to want to do that, that's something that you want to do. It had nothing to do with what I was doing or what I had, my performance, because I always played at that level from time I got there, understood what he expected out of us. So that was the only time like that, you know, we would have had, you know, it would have been us not agreeing with what was about to happen.
Right. And that's something he was pushing our buttons. I think he understood how good we were, not just us two, but our team. And for Delk and I, man, we were, you know, we were captains, and we had some, you know, everybody looked up to us. Everybody looked up to us. You know, we were like the big brothers, no matter if, you know, if you were a senior or whatever. So everybody looked up to us and followed our lead. So I think he knew that. And that was another way to push our buttons, man. And it worked.
Well, put it like this. I couldn't play any harder.
Right, exactly.
You got the most out of me. I'm like, listen, dude, this is all you're giving me. Like, I've given this to you for 4 years now. You know what I'm saying? So if there's any more you can get, I mean, hey, dude, I don't know how you're going to get it out of me, because, you know, like I said, I gave it. And Walter tell you, man, like, yes. I went hard every day. He went hard. But even my freshman season, just learning how, just getting acclimated to the collegiate game, you know, because as I stated earlier, just knowing how to play, you know, not even, not on the collegiate level, but just knowing the transition, you know, just learning how to play the speed of the game, to play without the ball, which is probably the most difficult thing I had to do as a young player coming in. When, you know, when you're a two-time state leading scorer, you know, I always had the ball in my hand. You know, I had the green light. I could always get my shot, or the ball was always going to come to me. So I had to learn that our offense was going through mash, and I had to learn how to get my shots and pick and choose. But I was learning offenses. I was also watching the guys that were ahead of me. And that's the difference between, as you watch this Kentucky team, you don't have any veterans teaching the young guys how to play, whether they're a walk-on, whether there are guys that were there, you know, and didn't get a lot of minutes, is that you need someone who was in the fire with you. Because a coach can only give you so much, but when you have a player that is experiencing what it's like to wear that blue uniform, they understand, like, hey, dude, man, y'all got to come every day and practice. You know, give us your all. Buy into what Coach Kyle is teaching. So players, you know, based on how they play the game, who's teaching them the game, but what level you're trying to reach. Like, that's the difference.
Yeah, and for us, I remember, you know, early on when we struggled, we had guys around, you know, Jamel Martinez and Travis Ford, Dell Brown, guys who could really pick us up and, like, you're going to be all right, just do this or that. They don't have those guys, and they looking across the room or in the dorm, this is another freshman who's going to do the same thing they're going through. They don't know how to get out of it. You know, there's nobody to say, hey, you're going to be all right. I've been through this. This is what you got to do. Or, you know, they don't have that. So it's a tough situation.
Yeah. I got to go back to the LSU game real quick. Just like you said, you get everybody's best shot. Looked at the box score. I think that was Henderson's career high. He was a freshman that year, and that was his peak scoring night of his career at LSU. So he brought it because Kentucky was in town. When did you guys, you know, because it's 68-37 with 15 minutes left. When did y'all see them finally start to wobble? Or when did y'all in y'all's head say, we got them, or we about to get them? When did that happen? When did that moment go off for y'all?
We just kept plugging, man. Travis Ford was really, you know, we're not losing. Just keep plugging away. That was the talk. I remember in half, there was no instructions or anything like that in halftime. It was chaos. So there was no change of game plan or nothing like that. He just kept shuffling us in and out whenever we needed breaks. I know myself and Delk were on the floor a lot that night, and we were only coming out foul trouble or unless we needed a break. And I didn't even start that game. That was early on. That was one of those games where I kind of starting after that. I came in off the bench. And again, one thing that was good for me is I shot the three. And so that was a game where it really showed that, hey, this kid can shoot threes. Like, we got to start playing him. So we just, man, I don't remember just one moment. We just kept fighting, man. we just kept fighting. And, you know, things just started going our way. And it didn't happen just like that, but it's just, maybe Delk has a moment, but man, we was just, I didn't think we had it until the end of the game, you know, to be honest, because it was just like, man, we didn't fall all the way back and ain't no way we can lose this now, but right. We weren't thinking like that. It was just like, you know, we just kept playing.
Or like, you know, or you can get so close and lose by 1 or 2 points or go into overtime and lose. Like, that's what, in a scenario like a scenario that you look back and replay and in your mind, it never ends the way you want it to end. It's like you fought hard, you get back in the game, you tie the game up, and you lose on the last second shot, or it goes in overtime, you lose. Like, that's all. Those are scenarios that would possibly happen when we see games like that. It's like, now you go from cheering for LSU to like, now you want to see Kentucky win this game. You want to see them finish it off. And then somebody hits a shot, somebody fouls out, like something. It never turns, you know. And to me, it really was about 1 minute, man. When I made that pass to Walter, I think Trav hit a free throw. I hit a free throw. And I saw a lead that they couldn't, you know, 4 points. I was like, man, they can't make. We're not gonna foul them to get them a 4-point play. And now we just gotta let this shot clock run out, get the ball in, you know, to our best foul shooting hands. We gotta make free throws. And when I look back, man, it was. I tell people, you know, winning the championship was great. You know, having a career high, and you know, in the NBA, I said, but there was something that was special about that game. And I have that conversation with my friends and family, my kids, is that, you know, you never give up. When you can be down that many points on the road, a team is beyond hot. Like, it was like everything they threw up was going in. And we found a way to get ourselves back into game, but not to just to get overwhelmed by being on the road, them cheering for the Tigers. Because that game could have easily went from 30 points to 40 to 50
right.
points. To be honest with you, if Coach hadn't instilled that kind of fight in us, because that's the time when you just say, man, you know what? We beat team by 50, 60 points, and there is nothing you can do. It's like,
right?
I don't care what you do. You know, it's like you're going to lose this game regardless. It's almost right. like looking at our 9-16, and you're the assistant coach, and you're doing a scout for us. It's like, okay, he's a pro. Good luck, guys. What you want me to tell you? I mean, I can't give you a scout report on them dudes.
Yeah, and I'll tell you one thing. What that game did, and a lot of people don't think about it, but we learned how to fight. Well, we knew from all the individual instruction and practice, we had fight in us. But from winning that game, it carried over, because there was other times we were down. I remember being against a championship team, Arkansas, in an SEC tournament. We're down 12. Yeah. We're down 12 with 2 minutes to go. We come back and win.
Yeah.
Like, that's we down 12 with 2 minutes to go. And it happened another time. I can't think of who it was. But that game, LSU game, gave us like the – we're never out.
Yeah.
We're not out of it.
Yeah. We like I said, but you know what's so funny was that we couldn't wait to play them dudes again. Like the following year, we played them in Rupp Arena. Like we really – I want to say we 40-piece them dudes, man. You know, and that's what I'm saying. Like, these young players don't get a chance to experience that, because – we experienced that, you know, because I remember losing to Mississippi State as a junior on Valentine's Day. Like we only lost two games in Rupp Arena, and I can remember both of them. We lost to Arkansas. We were number one in the country. We was up at halftime. We came out and laid an egg the second half. And then Mississippi State beat us Valentine's Day. So we had a chance to go back down to Starkville our senior year. And I didn't forget it. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, man, these dudes came in and, you know, because we won about 25, 30 games in a row at home. We hadn't lost at home in a while. And, you know, so Arkansas beat us. So I never forgot that. You know, it's just the competitive mindset that I have. And I try to tell my kids, I say, you have to hate losing. You have to remember losing, how you lost, who you lost to. But you have to stay in a place or be at a university for a while, really to get that understanding of what a coach is talking about when you've been coaching in a conference where, you know, like I said, what Walter said earlier, man, you think these other programs, these other coaches feel bad for Kentucky right now.
Absolutely. Not at all.
Hell no, they don't feel bad for Kentucky. Kentucky been beaten up on so many of these teams that have and have gotten coaches fired, you know, because everybody's trying to be like, man, how do we get to where Coach Cal is at right now? We got to fire another coach and bring another coach in. So this is their year to abuse us, you know, and it's okay because you know what? We've done it for decades.
Right, right.
That's it. I got to take a quick second because we got a new sponsor on the podcast, and we got to talk about another one that, before we get off, that both of y'all know very, very well, but this one is eBay for everybody in the sneaker game. Got to take a brief moment to talk about eBay, whether it's rare dead stock or the latest release, find the exact shoe you're looking for. As the original sneaker marketplace, eBay is the place to go to cop the pair you've been eyeing. With eBay's authenticity guarantee, your sneakers are meticulously inspected by independent professional authenticators. A team of experienced sneaker authenticators, easy for me to say, verify the box, logo, stitching, and dozens of other inspection points. Each sneaker also receives an authenticity guarantee tag that includes a digital stamp of authenticity, and it also protects sellers with a verified return process. And for sneaker sellers out there, eBay has eliminated selling fees on sneakers $100 or more, making it free to sell or flip your collection. Go to ebay.com/sneakers today. eBay, the world's best destination for discovering great value and unique selections. So are y'all big sneaker heads? TD, I think you talked a little bit about sneakers a little bit. We ain't talked about it a lot. Y'all, like PJ Tucker for the Rockets. That dude got sneakers. Y'all big sneaker guys or? Kind of.
I'm not as bad as Delk. I got a lot of sneakers, but I'm not as bad as Delk. Delk was always going to sneak ahead. Always.
Hey, it's so funny. I have three pair on the way as we speak right now. I'm kind of disappointed. I'm checking, man, because I'm supposed to be getting one today, and my package wasn't delivered. I'm like, man, come on, man. I'm not going to deliver my shoes, man. I've been waiting on my shoes for a couple weeks now, so. Yeah, man, I've always loved sneakers. Going back to when I even bought my first pair of Jordans. You know, I had to be the first person at my school with them Jordans on. So I told my brother, I'm like, listen, man, I need you to go wait. Because back then, you know, you had to wait in line to get shoes. Like, the store opened at 10 o'clock. Like, you had to be there. And I told my brother, because we had to drive an hour to Memphis. I said, man, I need you to be there at 10 o'clock. This is my brother Les, who wasn't. He worked like 3 or 4 days in a row. He was off for a couple of days. But this particular day, he was off. I said, dude, I need you to be there at 9 o'clock when the store opened. I need these Jordan so I can wear them in the game tonight. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, you know how to get that first pair of Air Jordan? Because when they came out then, they were just only coming out in that whatever year it was, that style. So if the fours came out, you know, there was all fours that came out. And wasn't that many that came out. But even like to this day, I've always loved like just sneakers. And I guess because, you know, when you can't afford them and you only have one or two pairs, like they all purpose, you know, they for church, they for playing outside, mm-hmm. you know, they for walking, they for school. So I say, if I'm ever in a position to buy some sneakers, I'm going to have me a lot of sneakers and they're going to stay clean. Cause if you only have a couple pairs, they get dirty really fast, especially with me playing in my backyard on a dirt basketball court, they stayed dirty. Matter of fact, I had to leave them on the front porch.
We talked about Ashton Hagens on several episodes of the podcast. If you even had a guy like him back on this Kentucky team, Walt, I mean, he's a big-time veteran compared to the way the roster is now. He gets suspended by the Timberwolves G League team, the Iowa Wolves, for violating COVID protocols and gets replaced by Isaiah Briscoe. So,
oh, did he?
Yeah, Briscoe is the one that took his, they brought in Briscoe after they waived Ashton. TD and I talked about it. Walter, I asked him, I said, you know, y'all played a decade in the league at various stages of your career, say the first quarter of your career, the second quarter, divided into four quarters, how would you have handled playing and being a pro athlete in a pandemic, depending on how old you are, in the early part of your career, in the later part of your career? How do you think you would have responded and reacted?
I think a lot of it depends on who my veterans are. you know, because you're doing whatever your veterans tell you to do. Like I came in, I was with the Knicks. I had Charles Oakley, Buck Williams, Herb Williams, Patrick Ewing, John Starks, Chris Childs, Charlie Ward, Allen Houston, Larry Johnson, Charles Oakley, Scottie Brooks. I ain't messing up.
You know what I'm saying? You got a couple goons too.
Yeah, I got some goons. So I would have handled it great. They would have said, be in your room. I would have been in my room. Be in practice, I might practice. Be now. So, you know, I think that's the difference. So early on in my career, like with those guys, I would have been fine because those guys would have had me in check. They would have had my ear.
Mm-hmm. And so you got Ashton, and look, y'all know the game is all about shooting now. He's not a great shooter. And then he's on a G League team, and now you kind of burning that opportunity down by violating COVID protocols.
He definitely burned that opportunity down. But when you think about like a player like Emmanuel Quickley, like prime example of a player that's doing extremely mm-hmm. well for the Knicks right now. So he came back and worked on his game. You could tell he went back in the lab and, you know, went from being probably an undrafted player to a first round draft pick that's in the rotation that's playing extremely well right now. He came back and worked on his game. So sometimes you can't let your ego or your family or people around you get you to do something that you're not ready to do yet. Because obviously Ashton Hagen was not ready to be an NBA player, wasn't mature enough. There was a lot of things that he could have worked on as a player, and in his mind, he was better than what he thought he was. You know, so sometimes it's a rude awakening to a player. But, you know, you take Emmanuel Quickley, P.J. Washington, those guys came back and got better. We saw those guys mature and become NBA players. And that's where I didn't see Ashton Hagen, because there's time during the season where, you know, I saw him, I was like, maturity level. Okay, is he a leader? I didn't think he was a good leader. And it's not to knock on Coach Cal as they recruit these players, but, you know, having the maturity and looking at someone like Walter stated earlier, like when I look at Emmanuel Quickley, I'm like, man, I'm watching what he's doing so I can come back one more year. It doesn't hurt because you take yourself out of being a potential draft pick to going undrafted. But, and that's what Emmanuel Quickley did. He took himself from being a late second round, maybe not undrafted player, to not only being drafted, but he's in the rotation right now. So yeah. Whoever his camp was, they gave him great advice. And he also, not only great advice, that advice led him to come back and really to work on his craft. Because it's one thing to start hearing what people think you are, and you, in your mind, you think you're that player. But you know, and here's the thing about Walter, can tell you this right here too. After I've seen you practice a couple times in the NBA or G League, we know if your ass is an NBA player or not. Like, yeah. We know that within 3 or 4 practices. It don't take no month. We're not no analytical dude sitting back saying like, okay, the analytics say, well, if he goes right, he's a better percentage shooter going that way off 2 dribble step back. No, we know within 2 or 3 practices if you are an NBA player. It don't take long.
It's one thing I always say when kids ask me or people ask me, I always say, listen, the league will call you out. It's like you're on an island when you leave, because either you got it or you don't, you know. And I mean, we know.
Both of y'all spend a lot of time in Boston. Just how strong is the culture to hate the Lakers? Is that, I mean, do they like beat that into y'all as soon as y'all get there, or is it just? You just know the city hates the Lakers. Is it just everywhere you go? What's the vibe for that
situation? Hold on. Before Walter answers this.
That's why I started laughing. I knew it was good.
Hey, it wasn't hate the Lakers. I hated the cold. I could care less about the Lakers, man. When I left Phoenix and went to Boston, I hated the cold. Ooh. I didn't care who they was. I didn't care who was in the conference. I didn't care about the Lakers. It was the cold weather. So, all right, Walter, you can answer the question.
I think it's different for everybody. And I think it's like for the Celtics, it's obviously the fans and the people who played in the era, in that era with the Bird era, when, you know, the Russell era, when they had those great matchups. Mm-hmm. You know, for us, when we play, man, it was the 76ers, you know, like that was our rivals. But it's like, man, at Kentucky, everybody hates Louisville.
Yeah.
Right? Like, but everybody made such a big deal out of this game, and they were asking us about it. We're like, we want to win every game. We don't care if it's Louisville, if it's Tennessee, right. Indiana. Like, we didn't care. We all came from different places. We didn't come from Kentucky, so we didn't care about that stuff. It's the same thing with with the Celtics. Like, the fans, especially, they hate the Lakers because of what they've seen in the past with the Will Chamberlain teams and the Dre West and the Larry Birds and the Kevin, all those rivalries that they had, and Cedric Maxwell. That had nothing to do with us. Like, we weren't a part of those games. And on the organization, that's just something that they've, you know, it's a great way to make money, sell gear. And but that was a different time. Players want to go out and compete and show they're the best. They don't care if it's the Lakers, if it's the Timberwolves, if it's the Heat. It's about showing up and winning and trying to dominate every team, to me.
I think Walter stated best, you know, just that, you know, Louisville to me never was a rivalry. You know, I never saw it as a rivalry game because, you know, as Walter just stated, we're all from different places. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it was a game on the schedule that, of course, we wanted to win, you know, because we wanted to be the best team in the state, of course. But when it came down to, like a Alabama, Auburn, like that kind of blood, that kind of fuel where, you know, family members have killed each other. Nah, dude, it wasn't that serious with us. And even as I got to Boston, you know, we played the Lakers. The robbery wasn't there. Like, we knew about what happened in the 80s with Mikhail, Larry Bird, Magic, James Worthy, Kareem, Robert Parris, Dennis Johnson. Like, we knew about all, because we knew the game. We knew the history of the game. And that's something that this generation is not that familiar with. But, yeah, I knew all those dudes. Like, I love seeing Cousy. I love seeing Bill Russell, man. Yeah. Like, just to see them dudes walk in that were legends. When I say legends, iconic legends for the NBA game, you know, that's what I was more impressed about, with just seeing them walk through that door. Other organizations I played for, you know, they didn't have Robert Parris, Kevin McHale, Larry Bird. Like, no organization I played for could bring three guys in. You'd be like, them three Hall of Famers right there. Them three dudes that my family grew up watching. That's how important they were to the game of basketball. And, you know, going back to college, it was, you know, like I said, we battled, we played. There was no team that maybe Arkansas became a quick rivalry with us, you know, because we played similar styles. And for me, I almost went to school there. So it was more about the guys who were my hosts, you know, those were the guys that I was playing against. And same thing with Louisville, like some of them dudes like Jason Osborne, like I think it was Osborne, I think Jason, Jason came down, like a couple of them dudes like Tick Rogers, like I knew them dudes, man. Them dudes weren't no bad guys.
Right.
I mean, guys that
DeJuan Wheat, all those guys. Yeah, we knew them very well.
Them dudes, man. If they came to Lexington, like they hung out with us. We went to Louisville, they looked out for it. Wasn't like, okay, man, like it was like, okay, we're gonna fight these dudes because they're in our city, or we were just cool because we accepted each other, and we all love basketball at the end of the day. And like I said earlier, some of these dudes came down to Kentucky. They came down to Lexington, and you know, we hung out and they did their thing, we did our thing. There was never no beef between us.
Yeah, it was really about the fans, you know, same when I knew all the guys with Indiana. Duck knew all the guys who played at Tennessee. So that was for the fans.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. Really, to be honest with you, yeah, it really was. You know, and that's what's so funny about, you know, us coming from different states is that we played them schools, you know. So it was like, man, I was recruited by Tennessee. Walker was recruited by Indiana. So when I came back to play Tennessee, you know, what made it hard for me, you know, you know, not playing with my home state team was that I really like Wade Houston, but I didn't see them getting me to the level I wanted to get to. And with nothing against this coaching, I just felt like when Billy Donovan came in, they had already had a game plan for me, you know, like, and when you can think ahead, and that's kind of how Coach Pitino, you know, his thought process is, you know, he's a proactive thinker. And that's something else he implemented with us. You know, we all became like, as we got into coaching, training, and commentating, is we're proactive. As I'm watching this game, like, I'm seeing things develop a lot slower, you know, because I'm older, and maybe that's the reason why too. But, you know, he really slowed the game down for us and started having us think the game. And with Walter being a versatile four, pick and pop player, he didn't think like a traditional four, like a traditional power four. He thought as a guard. So I knew whenever he got into coaching, I was like, he's going to be a different coach than most bigs. You know what I'm saying? Because most bigs are centers. And I'm like, them dudes not successful. And it's only because they only saw rim run. Walter got a chance to handle the ball. He know about passing. He know about using screens. He can make the three, which is now the game, the outside game, keeping the court space with player moving, the ball moving. So as soon as he got into coaching, I was like, he's going to be fine. Like, it never wavered that he wasn't going to be a good coach whenever he got his chance to be a head coach.
I got to ask y'all about Draymond Green. He was an athletic. He called out the NBA's double standard for players who request a trade versus teams who sit a player in order to trade him. He's kind of calling out the hypocrisy of that. So what are y'all's thoughts on those scenarios? It's a business, and y'all been on different teams and know how the game works. Y'all agree with his thoughts on that? Or
I thought he was spot on. You know, if you got a guy who says, all right, I need to be traded or whatever, everybody shits on you. Or everybody, like, but the team can come out and say, we're going to set you because we want to trade you, letting everybody know we're trying to trade you, right? I mean, it's the same thing. So I get what he's saying. I definitely agree. I definitely agree with him. It's got to be equal. It's got to be both ways. If you can't be mad at the player because he wants to leave or he's looking to get out. I mean, think about it. So why are they giving Deshaun Watson a tough time, but they let J.J. Watt go? You know what I'm saying? How that's playing out. It's the same thing. So it needs to be done better. But I agree with Draymond. I think he's right on it. I think if you're going to find players who are saying that are bad-mouth them or try to say this guy's a cancer, but you as an organization, you can say, hey, we want to trade this guy. We're going to set him out. Unless a team, the player and the team, they've come together to have a mutual agreement and said, hey, you know, I want to set out because I want to be traded. I don't want to get hurt to mess up a trade. If there's a mutual agreement, then I get it. So we don't know that. But from how he set it up, I agree with him. But there's a lot of times some of these guys do know they've been traded and they've requested it and they've worked some deal out. So I think it just depends on your situation and if that person's had talks with the GM. But I think it was because not everybody does what James Harden does, and you know, not everybody can do it what he did. But mm-hmm. You know, so I think
go ahead, Walt.
I was saying he knew what he had to do in order to get himself out of there. He's been around that organization long enough. And so James Harden, he knew what he had to do to get out of there. You saw the other day, he apologized and said no hard feelings, but that's what he had to do to get out of that situation. And so it's different for everybody.
I think, like I said, you know, with Drummond, it's coming out ready to play, and then they tell you not going to play. You know what I'm saying? So right. It's like,
yeah.
You know, you could have told me this before I got to the ring. You know, you didn't just make this decision, you know, when I got there. So I can understand, like, it could be embarrassing to him and his family, his kids that came to watch their dad perform. And he has to tell them, like, well, they didn't want me to play because they didn't want me to get hurt. I'm about to get traded. And it's hard to explain to your kids. You know, they were like, well, what do you mean? You know, you're putting up good numbers. But they want to see another player perform that's younger than you. And like Walter stated, when the team, the organization, there's no backlash to the organization. Right. Haven't seen it yet. Where they just destroy organization. They destroy the players. When a player is not happy or he know the writing on the wall, like, we're not going anywhere. Although I'm getting paid a lot of money, which is so people look at the money. That's all they care. They look at, okay, not about this guy had to uproot his family. Oh, he's not winning. You know, he's not satisfied. He's giving the team all he can give him. You know, that's when I look at LeBron when LeBron left Cleveland. Like, he gave Cleveland seven to eight really good years of his playing career. And he knew he wasn't gonna win a championship with what was constructed in Cleveland. So he had to make the move and become a villain to come back, you know, and win a championship. And it's like, oh, but the great thing about LeBron is he went back to Cleveland. As all the stuff that Dan Gilbert had to say about him, and there was a lot of bad stuff. And I'm not talking about the stuff that re-rigged. You can only imagine what he had to say to his little buddies and his friends that we never heard about. And LeBron was man enough to go back to his home state and win them a championship and left. You know what I'm saying? So he did what he's supposed to do. How many players who have ever been in this game were able to do what he was able to do and bring a championship to that, to the place that drafted him, the place that loved him, a place that when he left burned his jersey? Can you imagine? You gave him 7 to 8 years of your best, the best years of your career, and they burn your jersey because you become a free agent. That means I am free to go where I want to go. Nobody owns me. And I think in Dan Gilbert's mind, he's like, how can you leave? You know? And that's just how I look at different players. And like I said, with these players having a platform, things have changed. You know, you can be a person that come out and speak what we probably couldn't do as role players. But when you are a star, you have a platform, you make $25, $30 million, and you're not worried about, I'm about to lose $200,000 or $300,000. I'm about to lose my job. I've already set myself and my family up. I'm going to say what's on my mind now. And that's where most of these guys are at right now, even the Deshaun Watson, is that if he don't like what the organization has been doing, he has a right to leave. Because if they decide, like, you, if you're not playing well in football, what are they going to do to you? They're going to cut your ass. You know what I'm saying? They're going to cut your ass and have you restructure your contract, and then that's the end of it. But do those billionaire owners, do they take a pay cut? I haven't seen none of them take a pay cut yet. But they want us to stay loyal and take a pay cut when it's our time to become a free agent, get paid the most money we're going to possibly pay, and they want a hometown discount. Okay, then. How did y'all, when y'all became billionaires, how did y'all become billionaires? Is that y'all didn't take no discount. I look at Netflix. Netflix actually went up. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, think about, and that's a billionaire that owned that company. Amazon the same. Jeff Bezos, yeah. He might have had to give up some shares in divorce, but he's still sitting on about $100+ billion. Did Amazon prices go down? Nope, sure it didn't. But they want the players to take a discount. Come on, man.
Well, man, we know you can sing. We know you got albums. You got a catalog of music out there. I gotta ask, which came more naturally, singing or hooping, and which is easier or harder to do in front of a crowd, and you know, on a big stage?
I mean, singing came first because I started when I was young, in church, really young, 4 or 5. So that was, I've always done that since I can remember, and I started playing ball probably 5th to 6th grade, but. Singing definitely came easier because I think for me, basketball, you know, when you're 6'10", there's some point there's a lot of growth spurts. And so you have all the awkwardness and the coordination issues. And so I was awkward and uncoordinated all through middle school. And then it finally started to click beginning of my freshman year. And that's when things started getting easier. So it didn't start getting easy until, you know, probably 14, 15 years old. But as far as doing in front of the crowd or whatever, you just get in the zone. I don't know if it's basketball, music, I'm just enjoying it.
Cool. Now, which is the tougher business? The NBA, because that's a business. The music industry is cutthroat and tough as well. You've done both. Which Which is the more difficult?
So obviously they're both tough, but music, there's you're competing against so many more as far as trying to be successful. There's because everybody, there's, you know, we all got neighbors, people down the street. We know everybody trying to be a musician or whatever. For me, I knew my calling was basketball. So obviously I put a lot more time into that. And my thing was, I was never trying to be a superstar music person. I enjoyed doing it. It was a hobby. But I knew what my calling was. But I think it's the same, man. You in order to be successful, you got to be great at both of them. There's no, you know, you really got to really work your craft. And now music, I think, is a tougher business as far as business wise, because there's just so many things that you have to understand as far as being successful that you don't in basketball. You know, basketball is just about going out there playing, earning the spot, but you get what comes from that. But there's music is just a whole different world. There's a lot of language barriers that you have to get through, and you talk about royalties. It's just a dirty business. Basketball is much easier from that aspect, from a business standpoint.
And last question I got in Kentucky and in the NBA, who were the toughest, most challenging matchups? You know, guys that you had to face, you know, at Kentucky and in throughout your NBA career.
Man, so again, we talked earlier when I was early on. You know, I'm trying to put on weight. Coach Peeps playing me at the five, at the center, and so I was pretty much outmatched everybody I played against. So, you know, Charles Claxton, Demetrius Hill, who played for Florida, man, his big body, man. You talking about just the meat hook. Him and guys like Eric Dampier, man. Look, those guys are so big and so strong, man. And, you know, obviously by the time I was a senior, my junior year, I started, you know, adding strength and weight so I could be successful. But early on, man, those matchups were tough, man. Charles Claxton, the meat hook, and Eric Dampier, Corliss Williamson, a lot of those guys. But, I mean, lucky for me, man, in the summers, I got to play against Jamal Mashburn every summer. And no one was tougher than him. I think that really helped me out as far as, you know, playing against people. You know, Jamal was always tough to guard from college into the pros. But I think he really helped me out. But those guys like Charles Claxton, guys who were just 300 and something pounds, and I'm 210, I'm 215 trying to guard them, man, it just wasn't fair.
Man, we got to talk about our other sponsor on the podcast that looked TD, Walt, both of y'all, I think, are, you know, part owners. Talking about La Touraine, they got a 96 championship watch edition coming out. Only going to make 96 of them. You guys, look, saw Dave tweeting out the picture with y'all with watches on your arms. Photoshop that into the 96 championship picture. So they've been sponsoring the podcast. Y'all been endorsing them. We, you know, and that championship watch, man. Woo, that one was nice, man. It's a fire watch. So.
Yeah, shout out to Dave, a lot to Ray, man. Those watches are awesome. 25th anniversary, 1996 Wildcat watch, man. I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
I you know what? I'm excited, just like Walter is. You know, I wish our cast was having a better year. You know, that's always a selling point, is that, you know, but you know, it could be a different selling point. Like, hey, since the year has been so bad, you know, at least you can get something that that signifies that, you know, Kentucky was great at one point in time. You know, so maybe put this year behind us and come out and support what Dave and Walter, myself, and so many of us, you know, just putting a really good timepiece out, but just something commencing all the, you know, the years of that have passed, but also just being a part of a championship, you know, that a lot of teams, you know, we've had a lot of great teams, but, you know, just going back to cutting down the nets and being one of the greatest teams that ever played the game, you know, and I think when Dave started thinking about this along with Ben is, you know, we wanted to have something that was going to be meaningful, special, but also a timepiece that no one else will ever have, you know, so that makes it even more special. It's like when you win a championship, is that the players and staff, those are the only people, you know, that are going to get a ring for that year. And those rings are special. So every time there's a reunion, everybody comes back and we all have something in common. And so that's the one thing with, you know, with this watch is that just all that hard work we put in and, you know, it's still reaping the benefits of winning that championship and back in 1996.
For sure.
Yeah, the 96 watch, they got the compass, they got the Voyager, they got a wide variety. LaTerrain.com, Dave has got you covered. Any type of watch you want, they got you. So had to definitely get that in too, in addition to everything else. But man, it's been fun chatting with you all, dropping knowledge on here, catching up with TD. Talked about the singing, the Odd Couple, all kind of stuff on here tonight, man. So everybody go to Bleed.com. Give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast. Word of mouth, tell your friends. If you got friends that you know would like this podcast, tell them. If you're on social media, tweet about it, post about it, copy the link and text it to your friends. And everybody just enjoy this episode and check out the other ones that we done had archived from the previous episodes as well.
Peace out, y'all. Good job, V.
Appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me. Hey, thanks for being a part of our podcast, man.
What's up, brother? All right. Anytime, man.
Appreciate it.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.